Well, it's Richard Mackey and Graham Zilm with the UBC Law History Project, and we're talking to Mike Harcourt. It's the 23rd of November 2012, and we're on the on the seventh floor of a unnecessarily high building in somewhere in downtown Vancouver, but we are here, and welcome, Mike. And I would start by asking you about your early life. I see you were born in Edmonton, so was I. Did your parents do? What did your dad do? Why were you born there, and when did you come to this part of the world?
Well, I hope it was University Hospital you were born in.
Yes.
I was born in University Hospital.
Same hospital, yes, I was.
January 6, 1943. Yeah. And my father was born in Calgary in 1912. My mother was born in Lethbridge in 1911. And so my dad lived in Calgary for his first 5-6 years, and then family moved to Burnaby. Mm-hmm. And he graduated from the Burnaby South, class of 29. Mm-hmm. And then he, after scratching and scrambling during the Depression, he ended up in Alberta selling McLean's magazine subscriptions and diesel mechanic courses. And so he and my mother.
Was this in the Depression?
Depression, and he and my mother met in Calgary. We're married in 1937, but he that's what he was doing to make money. And did okay at it. He'd start the morning with a full tank of gas and enough for coffee and the hotel bill and my mother having breakfast. And he'd go out and see a farmer out doing his stuff in his field, and he'd stop and inquire, get the farmer to come over the fence. And and basically he was saying that, I'm looking for really intelligent, forward-looking people that want to get into the technology of the future, which is diesel. And he'd get the farmer interested, and he'd go back to the farmhouse, he'd sell the diesel mechanic course, which became very helpful to these people, because when the Second World War started, being a diesel literate was a very good skill. And he'd say to the wife, he would sell McLean's magazine subscriptions at the same time, right? So he'd get a double hit and get the initial down payment and go back and pick up my mother and go on to the next stop.
So this was all in the country, or was he in the city too?
Mostly in the country. And then he went to work with Prudential of America in the life insurance business. And that was what he was doing when I was born, but about just around the time I was born, or just after, he came home in full Navy gear. My mother was horrified. He'd signed up for the Navy. So we ended up following him a few months later to back to Cornwallis and Halifax, and he ended up being in a safe pastime of being on destroyer escorts and frigates in the Second World War, chasing Nazi subs away from, or trying to get them, chase them away from convoys. So he did that for a couple of years. Then we moved back here. My brother was born, and my dad was in charge of discharge as a lieutenant in the Canadian Navy. And he went back to working with Prudential of America. I grew up in Victoria in Vancouver, so the usual Leave It to Beaver Classic. Life. Mother at home making chocolate chips and brownies, and dad out in the cruel hard world of business.
Were you in the suburbs or?
We lived, most of the time in Vancouver, we lived in and around southwest Vancouver. Mm-hmm. At 54th and Osler for a significant period, and then moved to Victoria for 5 years, lived in Oak Bay behind the Tweed Curtain. Mm-hmm. And then from there went to back to Vancouver, lived at 52nd and Churchill, and finished up at Churchill High School, and then went from there to UBC, a BA and a law degree. And summer job was working on the CPR trains as a dining car waiter, started as a pantryman, dishwasher, which was a good summer job because you worked for 5 days, then you had 5 days off, so you had basically half the summer off.
How far did you get on the train?
Winnipeg and then down Thief River Falls in Minnesota. So we're doing all the tours, going to Banff and Lake Louise, and then out and back to Chicago, Minneapolis. And pretty great summer job. It was a good bucks. I was making about $600 a month in the 60s. I don't know what that would translate to now. Probably about $3,000 a month.
Sounds like it.
So that was enough to cover the $400 a year tuition. $100 for books, $100 for the Beta Theta Pi fraternity, car, and beer money at the Fraser Arms.
And what did they have majors then, or what did you focus on as an undergraduate?
UBC, I took a BA in political science and English, literature, double major.
You said that earlier you had been on the school
student council in high school.
Council, so you always had a political
kind of
interest?
Yeah, I was grade seven. I was the grade seven class president at Lansdowne, sort of middle school
in Victoria.
Yeah, and grade nine vice president of the student council, and then moved back to Vancouver after half a year at Oak Bay High, kind of back into the same neighborhood with the same kids that had grown up with me and at David Lloyd George and Sir Wilfrid Laurier High School, just off of 57th, 59th, and Oak. I was grade 11 class president and grade and the high school president for Churchill High. So I, kind of got into elected office early.
That's a question that I've been curious about in these interviews when I think of you or Sam Robinson and the other politicians who have gone through the law school. What came first? Did the political a political interest precede law, or did law get you interested in politics? Or it sounds like you've always had some kind of elected or student role anyway.
Well, I was not really into partisan politics most of the way through UBC. I was kind of new left to a certain extent, plaguing all political parties and political houses, and kind of evolved into it. I was thinking of doing a PhD in political science, but decided to go into law instead. Because I figured you better learn the rules of the game to change the game. And if we needed to make big changes, which at the time I thought we did, because I was very opposed to the American involvement, the Vietnamese War, and the colonial overrun of peoples all over the world, and the injustice and unfairness that was around, and significant poverty and the First Nations issues. And so I thought it'd be, if you wanted to be actively involved in making those changes, the sort of skeleton of our democracy is the legal system. And the way you make laws or change laws or make change, reform what is not a society that required revolution, like a lot of societies were too far gone, too corrupt, too overrun with authoritarian regimes to change peacefully, but certainly not in Canada. I remember as a student going to, I think it was last year of my BA or first year of law, I went to a meeting of all the radical groups at UBC, including the ones that let a greased pig loose in the faculty club. Mm-hmm. Jerry Rubin came to visit and all hell broke loose. Faculty were quite outraged about that. I had nothing to do with it, by the way. But I remember going to this group with a huge number of Marxist-Leninists, Trotskyites, Stalinists, New Left, you name it. And they were talking revolution in Quebec in 1972. That's when it all happened in the rest of Canada shortly thereafter. And I'm looking at them and thinking, you guys are nuts. This is not going to occur. I mean, changes do need to happen, significant changes, but you ain't it. You're off in some Lululand. So I basically wasn't that hugely engaged in politics, except fortuitously coming across Canada in the CP trains, who should be traveling from Ottawa back to his home riding in Nanaimo, the islands, but Tommy Douglas. And it was a slow run, and I had a chance to chat with him, you know, because I was curious about politics, and I was hugely impressed with him. As a, you know, very approachable, he was willing to talk with me, and I was asking him all kinds of questions, and from that I then started to read up on the CCF, and you know, I was deeply involved in the citizen participation, and change could happen organically from, not as an anarchist, but as a person that believed in grassroots democracy and that. And I thought the CCF was the one. That would be 60. One. See, I went into law school in 65, so it would be probably somewhere in that period.
Yeah.
And I was really quite intrigued by this terrific man, and started to read up on the various parties, conservative, liberal, NDP, and of course the Social Credit Party that started. My grandfather was Pentecostal, religious-wise, and had a small town, Taylor, and believed in the Social Credit A plus B theorem. And then alongside that was the United Farmers of Alberta and the CCF, which all kind of got going around the similar time. So I started reading up, and of course I had my poli-sci background, and still wasn't into politics in a big way. Wanted to go overseas with CUSO after I got my law degree, and learned they really didn't need lawyers in Thailand or other countries like that. They needed nurses and teachers and engineers. And so I thought, well, maybe I should look at the domestic Peace Corps program, do a couple of years after I got out of law school and out of articles doing that. And in law school, I started talking with one of the professors, Jerome Atrins, who was a criminal law prof from Saskatchewan, terrific guy. And we started to talk about legal needs and locally in Vancouver. And from that, in second year law, evolved an interest in the then Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, the Great Society, and part of that was the legal services program. So we read up on that and made contact with the closest office. It was all across the United States. It was in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And went down to Seattle to visit this office in East Seattle in the large black population ghetto area of Seattle. They were really just enthralled by the type of work they were doing, specializing in poverty law, the problems of poor people. It's pretty apparent that the legal system really didn't work well for poor people, low-income people. And all that was available was either lawyers doing it pro bono, just at their own choice, or I think Wednesday nights at the courthouse, now the art gallery, there was a free legal aid where a certain number of lawyers would show up and give free legal advice and sometimes take on a matter if it was an undefended person in a criminal action or they needed some civil advice. But they didn't get paid for it. There was no legal aid system. There was no access except, you know, a lawyer offering some sort of legal advice. So out of that evolved an interest in setting something up here in Vancouver through the third year law and out into articles. I worked with Jerome and a number of other people to look at how we'd set up a similar sort of a service. Discovery, we really didn't have a ghetto. I mean, we had the downtown east side, Skid Row, it was then known, sort of two blocks around Main and Hastings, but a lot of poor people. You know, we knew there were people suffering, and we knew there were poor people. Legal problems around landlord and tenant, debtor-creditor issues, matrimonial, family, child welfare, government bureaucracies that were pretty cruel to people, the workers, it was called Workers' Compensation Board, unemployment insurance, welfare agencies. The laws were written in favor of the government, the banks, landlords, creditors, and certainly biased massively against low-income people who didn't have legal representation or legal advice at the minimum. And we were very fortunate because we had a wonderful dean, George Curtis, who got it and who sanctioned us doing the due diligence on access of the legal system to low-income people and experimenting with how we would do it, and opened doors for us with the Law Society, the Canadian Bar Association, and the major law firms in the downtown, and got agreement that we could recruit law students, train them, and then helped us to get the major law firms to go out and ask their, and lawyers in general in Vancouver, the Vancouver Bar, to participate and supervise at the clinics as volunteers, and for the students to get credit for this really valuable experience. I mean, it's the guts of being a lawyer, which is interviewing your clients, extracting, you know, the information you need, and then putting it into a legal context. And you say, well, that may be a moral issue, but it's not a legal issue, and all those sorts of things that lawyers are trained to separate out sometimes to the despair of their clients and the public. But so it was a really good experience for the law students and the lawyers. A lot of them were corporate lawyers and hadn't realized the extent of the misery of low-income people and not having access to legal services, not having the laws balanced.
Yeah, who else was involved with you? Was it your, were there other law students helping with this?
There were actually a number of law students I recruited through the through the summer, through some funding, through the Pierre Trudeau was the Prime Minister at the time and former Minister of Justice, and he started his a Just Society move, and just so happened that you know, when I came out of articles in 1968 9, we had a law school in 68 and out of articles in 69, that Pierre Trudeau had been elected as the Prime Minister, and his Minister of Justice was a fraternity brother of mine, John Turner, and who had two law students working, or one a lawyer, Dick Hayes, and Keith Mitchell, who's now the managing partner at Ferris and Company, staff, political staffers. And we were able to persuade him, and we got the Vancouver Bar and the Canadian Bar and the Law Society to put forward briefs that we needed to fund community law offices through the 12 major law schools in cities across the country, and to do core funding for 3 years for each of the 12. So we set up the legal services program at a student-directed social action agency out of an old abandoned United Church at 6th and Yukon that then shifted to your neighborhood to Victoria and East End Cultural Center, the Colch. Now. And Prior, I guess it is, that whatever the street is, the East-West Street. And set up the legal services program and what was called the Inner City Service Project. And I was able to have six lawyers, or law students, we called the Law Squad, who helped me run this. And the, Keith Mitchell was one of them. And there were five others, Al McLean and six of them, who helped us set up free legal advice clinics all over the city in storefront operations, because people were intimidated. Low-income people going into the high-rise with expensive furnishings in the reception area, and very intimidating for people. So we decided to make it welcoming, receptive, and have offices close to where people lived, because they couldn't afford cars and transit system wasn't all that good. And we'd have evening clinics, and law students would come, be supervised by volunteer lawyers. And we then also got funding to set up the Legal Aid Society, British Columbia. And I was one of the initial directors, along with people like Charlie Locke and John Bouck, and others who went on to become judges, were, you know, the leaders in the law profession in the major firms in Vancouver, and me on the board of directors. We hired Frank Masco and Brian Ralph, who went on to become judges as the first directors of the Legal Aid Society, basically dealing with criminal matters, later expanded to family and other areas, immigration and other areas, but that was the start. And it was based on per capita funding across the country that the federal government, through John Turner, made available, matched by the provinces. So that established the Legal Services Commission, as they call it now, the Legal Aid Society then, and the Inner City Service Projects Legal Services Program, which morphed into becoming the Vancouver Community Legal Assistance Society.
Was there opposition to the legal aid idea?
None. No, and it was a tribute to the bar. I mean, the lawyers in this town saw the need, saw that we were avoiding some of the concerns they had about the quality of the advice, about the supervision of law students, about any bad publicity for the bar. But they ran us through the paces to make sure that we covered off all of that. And after a while, they discovered that, you know, these are areas of the law that most lawyers didn't know very much about, because their experience was working for banks or working for governments or working for landlords, or didn't do family law. That was too messy, and, you know, they were mostly commercial lawyers or litigators and or estate lawyers and real estate. And that there was a unique perspective that tenants had, that debtors had, that people dealing with government bureaucracies. And we became very good at it, because we were dealing at one, you know, we built up to about 10,000 cases a year. You know, you interview 10,000 people, you start to see patterns, and you start to see the same problem popping up, and you start to see a part of the debtor-creditor area where, for example, wages could be garnished. Well, as soon as you do that, the worker gets fired. Well, the worker gets fired, you don't get paid. Right? So, just stupidity. So we set up a debt counseling program where we got the bank or the financial institution together with the debtor and got them talking, because what happened is that there was a breakdown in communication. The debtor would get behind, the bank would start sending nasty letters, and then they'd send it to a collection agency or sue or garnish your wages instead of talking to each other. Well, how can we manage this? You know, how can we restructure your debt? And so we set up a debt counseling program that basically was a huge service to the financial institutions and to the debtor and to society, because you didn't throw somebody out of a job and they got a bad credit rep and a bad reputation and they, you know, welfare, whatever, and welfare was very hard to get. So those were the kind of things we were able to pinpoint, and changes to landlord and tenant law so it was more balanced, and administrative law changes so that justice would be done, fairness would take place for the people dealing with government agencies. So we were able to then either bring test cases or to do law reform, statutory reform, or in some cases take political action.
What kind of political action?
Well, the one that got me into civic politics, but you know, we would through the bar and through policy committees of the Canadian Bar Association, or directly, we would seek changes to municipal bylaws or federal, provincial statutes or policy changes, and we do briefs and present them and get people allied around a particular provision in the old Juvenile Delinquent Act, or child custody, or foster care, or debtor-tenant, or debtor-creditor, landlord-tenant issues. And while I was doing that, I was approached by two women, one a City Hall employee called Darlene Mazzeri, and she was a social planner with the City of Vancouver, and another one, Shirley Chan, who was a fire-breathing SFU student activist whose parents' home in Strathcona and business in Chinatown was about to be expropriated for the infamous freeway that was going to come from the North Shore along Stanley Park, elevated along our waterfront, wipe out Gastown and Chinatown, and 8 lanes along Venables and Pryor, connect up with the new freeway, the new highway,
the number one
highway in Burnaby, and then build, to take down all these homes and businesses and heritage areas and pay people totally ridiculous expropriation amounts, and build high rises, warehousing low income people in instant slums. And this was the idea of progress that was being promoted at the time, right? And it was part of the urban renewal idea. And the downtown business community was worried about the impact on their business of Park Royal and Guildford and Oak Ridge and other suburban shopping malls and centers. And they thought, well, this will be easy for people to come into the downtown if we build freeways and lots of parking lots. Oh, by the way, we'll just do this urban renewal. And so they approached me at my office and asked me to go to Shirley Chan and Darlene, who almost got fired, her boss in social planning, Morris Egan, who was the head social planner, who'd been an alderman in Ottawa, came out to take on this job, backed her up when she was seen to be not doing her job, which was to colonialize these basically Chinese people, Chinese Canadians, and the people in these old neighborhoods. that this was good for the city, and, you know, just get out of the way.
Was it Sutherland Brown? Was that the name of the
Gerald Sutton Brown.
Sutton Brown, yeah.
He was the city commissioner. He basically ran the show and the council at the time, the Nonpartisan Association, which is a misnomer. It's a totally partisan association. Their job is to keep the socialists out of City Hall, right? Mm-hmm. They basically came and rubber-stamped his city manager reports, and he was a Brit who thought that urban renewal was great, and he was an expert in what do these citizens know, right? And just give council enough to rubber stamp his expert opinion and that of the engineers and the planners, and urban renewal is good.
So it was so, the cult of the expert.
The cult of the expert and urban renewal, which was needed in Europe after the war because of the huge destruction and damage, and then it became part of North American planning, and you built 9-to-5 downtowns, and people lived in their suburbs, and they drove in their car on freeways to low-density suburbs where you didn't have enough density to provide bus service or public transportation. So that was the urban guru thinking at the time. Really a bad idea, and it's something that I opposed for a long time. And there's, you know, we started the whole livable city movement from that freeway debate. Interestingly, they came to see me and said, "Well, we've got a meeting at the first Jewish synagogue in the city in Strathcona," which became Gibbs Boys Club at the time, now a condominium development. And so I was invited 6 months into law practice, setting up the storefront lawyer program, to this community meeting where there was about 300, mostly Chinese, speaking in Cantonese. Hmm. 3 hours of meeting. Didn't understand a word. So at the end,
and it was in opposition to the freeway still?
Yeah, it was in opposition to the freeway, and their homes being expropriated and their businesses destroyed. And so there was two groups forming up, one the SPOTA, the Strathcona Property Owners and Tenants Association, representing Strathcona, and the Chinatown Merchants Association. And Shirley Chan's parents, who owned a family business in Chinatown, the father was a scholar from China, very well. Shirley was a fourth or fifth generation Chinese, interestingly enough. And the father was a great scholar and writer, and the mother was a real strong woman. And so they were the leaders of SPOTA. And Harry Fan, who was a pretty conservative business fellow, who had a business on Pender, a home on Pender Street. Shirley's parents, I think, were on Kiefer. They had this large gathering of merchants and residents at the Gibbs Boys Club and invited me, along with Darlene and Shirley, a few others. And I had this three-hour meeting in Cantonese, and at the end of it, they came up to me, Shirley and Darlene, and said, "Well, you're hired." I said, "Okay, I'm hired. What? You're our lawyer." "All right. So who are we taking on? I know who the client is. Who are we taking on?" They said, "Don't worry about it. Don't worry." I said, "No. Who are we taking on?" They said, "Okay, we're taking on the city hall, the provincial government, the federal government, the downtown business community, the development and construction industry, financial industry, the oil and gas industry, the auto industry. But other than that, don't worry about it." So being young and foolish, I said, "Okay." So we then came up with some strategies to oppose this freeway. And it was part of quite an awakening of the city, because we had other people, a new political party that had starting to form up called the Electors Action Movement, or TEAM, had elected Walter Hardwick, an esteemed urban geographer from UBC, and Art Phillips, who was a UBC grad in commerce, who was just starting Phillips Hager North, which is a huge wealth management company that just sold out for zillions to the World Bank, got elected to council as part of this reform movement. And and there were people like Arthur Erickson and architects right in Chinatown. Bud Wood and his people, Joe Wei, young Chinese architect, who were opposed to this grotesque idea of the freeway and the destruction of these heritage areas and these great neighborhoods. So there was quite a movement, but we were right at the pincer part of it with the Chinese community taking on City Hall. So we had buses of elderly Chinese senior citizens and neighbors descending on City Hall and occupying the galleries and petitioning the city and ready to sit in front of the bulldozers and stop any further destruction. And my job was to bail them out if there was any problem.
Did the destruction actually start? Because I know that the black neighborhood, I forget what it's called, but that was
wiped out. That was where the Georgia Viaduct was the start of the freeway, and then it was supposed to continue. That was to be the south part of the freeway system, and then it was joining up with the northern part, which would come along the waterfront and go right. Take out Gastown, Chinatown, and connect up with it, and then be, I don't know, six or eight lanes right along Venables and Pryor. And then the first phase, first two phases were already done, called Raymer Housing Project and McLean Park. Those are two public housing projects. And then they were going to do the third phase, which was getting rid of all the rest and building this freeway, right? And similar activities were taking place in the city of Toronto with Jane Jacobs, the esteemed, quite famous urbanist who wrote The Death and Life of Great American Cities and other Wealth of Cities and seminal books on urban planning and community participation and what makes a vibrant neighborhood. She just moved from New York, where she took on the equivalent of Gerald Sutton Brown, Robert Moses, who was a ruthless, infamous city commissioner in Montreal or in New York. She decided that she'd won some of those battles, lost some of them, but her sons were getting draft age, and the Vietnamese War was on, right? So she moved up to Canada and into Toronto and settled in Trafan Court in the Spadina area when the same thing happened. The powers that be at City Hall, provincial federal governments, wanted to build an extension of the Spadina Expressway, freeway, through her neighborhood. So she went at it again. And a couple of the people working with her went on to become very, very good mayors of Toronto, John Sewell, and the tiny perfect mayor, David Crombie. And so we started talking to each other. We were kind of like the nexus of opposition to this madness called urban renewal. And we're able to invite then Federal Minister Paul Hellyer's staff to come and talk to us. And these two guys showed up, Lloyd Axworthy, and another fellow, Dan Conrad, who saw these three strikingly attractive women, Shirley Chan, Darlene Missouri, and Penelope Stewart. One of them was married, Darlene, and the other two weren't. And that was a great motivation for them to listen to these women and hear what they had to say. And they were asking for dates, of course. And they asked, what do you want? And so we happened to have a draft telegram we wanted them to send that I drafted up. Dear minister, you know, the minister sent out across the country, stop all urban renewal programs, period. So they said, okay, we'll send it. And he did. The minister looked at it, signed it, sent it out, stop urban renewal across Canada.
So they were funding, the government was
The federal government was funding 50% of it, the province 25%, the city 25%. Well, that was quite a shock to the system. And then they sent deputy ministers to enforce the edict and they were very good deputy ministers, one from CMHC, King Ganon, and another one, Everett, deputy minister Everett from the province, and all of us descended on a shocked city hall. Where do we go from here? Okay, well, let's do two pilot projects. Let's do one in Strathcona and one in Toronto. And a whole different way of doing cities, like involving citizens in the future of their neighborhood, like actually having tax money be available for them to decide, do they want to build a Strathcona Community Center, they want to repave their streets that haven't been paved, they'd be red circle for 10, 15 years, maybe even have bilingual street signs in English and Chinese, and redo some of the parks and some social programming, and get rid of social housing, or get rid of public housing, do nonprofit co-op housing instead of big ugly towers that are being bulldozed and demolished all over the Western world now, still remaining in Russia, the Stalinist architecture that was copied, awful stuff. Let's build in scale to the neighborhood, mixed income, nonprofit co-op housing that's run by church groups and service clubs and others, and do local area planning, neighborhood improvement planning, residential rehabilitation, heritage preservation, and this nonprofit co-op housing, and an open participatory process, engaging citizens with governments. So we started that pilot project, and both of them worked quite well, and that spread then throughout the rest of the country and transformed Halifax waterfront, some of the old heritage areas in Quebec City and Montreal, and led to the St. Lawrence Market and a whole series of changes in Toronto and the Bytown Market in Ottawa and other parts of inner city Winnipeg and Edmonton, Calgary, Vancouver, Victoria, and profoundly changed the way we did urban issues in Canada. And out of that, I got mad at City Hall, decided to run for city council. And this is after I'd left the storefront lawyer program and I was in law practice and just being married in 1971.
And what were your politics at the time?
At that point, I had helped run. I was sort of like a plague on all parties, but was essentially value system of a social democrat, sort of the Tommy Douglas self-help, mutual aid, co-op, credit union, citizen participation, strong democrat, but a social democrat. I had run a campaign for Pierre Trudeau in 1968. Saw liberals up close and decided they weren't my cup of tea, and got involved with the NDP in 1969. And had run a by-election campaign for them in Vancouver South, and then ran a campaign for them in 1972, Gary Locke and Emery Barnes, when the NDP government got elected. But I was recruited by a team to run for council in 1972. I'd been out practicing for a couple of years by then, and just got married. And to my surprise and my new wife's horror, I was elected in 1972 to the city council. And we were very quick off the mark to fire the city manager, Gerald Sutton Brown, appoint his second in command, who was a pretty reasonable guy, Warren Ryan, fire the director of planning and seven of his top nine planners, rearrange the 15 departments by firing five of the top 10 department heads, top 15 department heads, and transformed the way we did business at City Hall. So it was quite a transformation of governance in the city. But it came out of this starting the storefront law office and being asked to represent citizens to stop this freeway, and then saying, you know, I don't like what's happening at City Hall. I got to do something about it. You want me to run? Fine. And but it came out of that community law experience, and I by that time handed off to Ian Waddell, who was a prosecutor, and he handed off to Harvey Field, another lawyer now. I think he's semi-retired provincial court judge in Surrey.
What about the influence of the 60s and the counterculture and the hippie movement? you were in the, you got your BA in 1965 and your law degree in 1968. That's right at the beginning of the hippie era. Was there a, how caught up with, how involved were you with student politics earlier?
I wasn't very involved with UBC politics. I was more involved with the bigger issues of the Vietnamese War, the New Left, without being SDS or any of the other organized groups. I thought the structures and the politics needed to be changed, transformed. So I wasn't into organized politics until I started running campaigns to try and make changes politically.
I should ask about your law school experience too. Was it a very conservative?
Oh yeah, place? Well, 80% of lawyers are quite conservative. Mm-hmm. I think to this day.
Yeah.
I got involved in student politics there because there was no contest, like nobody was running. And then a pal of mine, James Taylor, Jim Taylor. We had fat Jim Taylor and skinny Jim Taylor.
Right.
Fat Jim wasn't really that fat. He was just stocky sort of a guy. And lean Jim was quite lean. I said, well, listen, you run, and I'll run against you. I mean, you'll beat me, but let's have a contest at least, right? So I ran and lost to him. But that was my only experience. But it was really just to have an election. I didn't really want to be student council or law student president because I was off doing all this other stuff, right? But I really didn't get actively involved in politics until 68, and then, formed up my political party in 69 with the NDP. Got elected myself and to council in 72. It was a combination of people from various political parties, progressive conservatives, liberals, new Democrats, community activists. It was quite a student or a civic reform party. And then I was quite active in the NDP and electoral politics. I didn't get into the executive or table officers of the NDP, and wasn't involved with them until I became party leader in 1987.
So when it comes to the influence of the 60s, you mentioned Tommy Douglas, meeting him on the train. Were you
right?
Were you a hippie?
Well, I did have longer hair than I do now. I had long hair and a Fu Manchu, and I was, in practicing law, I helped set up a number of co-ops and communes, and I was involved with a lot of the counterculture. Not a great believer in any drugs except wine and scotch. But became involved with a group called became the chairman of the board of the Greater Vancouver Youth Communication Center Society, more commonly known as Kool-Aid, which was the equivalent of the Digger House in San Francisco, where we were dealing with what the bureaucrats called the traveling and transient youth, which was this lemming-like procession of people to Haight-Ashbury and 4th Avenue in Vancouver, into the Yorkville area in Toronto, and And so our rather than being part of the counterculture, we were there to keep kids alive from bad drugs and drug dealers, and feed them. And we had an old house at 7th and Burrard that was raided every second day by the police, and we had the fire and inspectors inspecting us all the time, and the police raiding it, and some of the mayor were quite enraged and huffing and puffing about commies and pinkos and hamburgers. That's what's wrong with this city, is too many commies, pinkos, and hamburgers. Tom Campbell. And I was quite honored to be called the hamburger, you know? So I did that, and we had at the Inner City Service Project, where I was sending up to the community law office, we set up the equivalent of what's now the crisis center. We had a feed-in where we were feeding 5,000 kids a day, and we were setting up, helping set up shelters and armories and that for these kids, and trying to get Children's Aid Society to rather than treat these kids as criminals and them behaving like bureaucrats, like only open from 9 to 5 Monday to Friday, when most of these kids needed help in the evening or on weekends, right? So I was kind of actively involved in a lot of those grassroots issues through these quite new startup programs or activities that became NGOs along the way. And so it was that was the kind of political activism that I did at a grassroots level.
So it was a pragmatic, practical. You came by it honestly through your involvement as a lawyer and involvement with local politics, city politics.
Yeah, and at the grassroots citizen neighborhood, organic issues in the community that you then formed up into initiatives, programs that were dealing with a real need that the existing services, bureaucracies, were unwilling or incapable of dealing with effectively.
How did your law partners or colleagues view your political
activities?
Activities. Were they supportive?
Well, my nickname in law school was Ho Chi Harcourt, and they kind of endeared me, because, as a matter of fact, I grew up on the west side of town, and they wondered, where did this, how could he be left wing? I mean, this is Carisdale and Shaughnessy. I mean, what the heck's going on here? And they kind of put up with me because we were pals, but it was different. They agreed to disagree with where my politics were going, but they were very generous with their own time, volunteering to help supervise the legal advice clinics, offer legal advice on some of the law reform stuff we were doing. John Fraser, who went on to become a conservative minister of fisheries, was one of the senior litigators at Lawson Lundell, as it was then known. I think it's McCarthy. What's it now? McCarthy Tetro. He had his firm volunteer all the furnishings when we went from the old United Church what's now the Kulch at Venables and Victoria. And we went up to about 11th Main, got an office there, and he furnished it with old furniture from his office, and got the law firm supplied us with a lot of our books, statutes, and other important resources like that. So they were very generous. I never felt any serious pushback, negative pushback. Mm-hmm. Tough questions. Mm-hmm. One is make sure things were run properly and well, and some bemusement at my politics.
But 1972 is the year of the sea change in BC history, with the NDP elected provincially. So you're, in a sense, you might have been part of a zeitgeist, you know, a new spirit of the age, of a, and there you are from the an insider who has embraced a new political party. Did you run it once for provincial politics, or did that take a while?
No, I didn't. I didn't run really for provincial politics until I'd finished 14 years.
Of course, you were
as a council member. I was elected four times as a council member in Vancouver, 72, 4, 6, 8. Then I ran for mayor in 1980, taking on what I saw as some serious, serious flaws of the Transpo 86, which became Expo 86. But it was quite a exciting period because we had, of course, the Just Society, the new Liberal government, and all the changes there that I was able to be part of in terms of the legal system and other important changes in housing approaches and a number of reforms. Subject, of course, to this was also the time of the War Measures Act, and it was the time of Richard Nixon, and it was the time of draft dodgers and deserters, and so a lot of us were involved in dealing with draft dodgers and deserters and helping them through police and immigration authorities. And of course you had the change of the city government 2 months after the change in the provincial government, both, you know, substantial changes to the politics of the city and the province, because, you know, you had this electors action movement, which after the NPA had run the city since 1932, and the social credit government had run the province from 1952 and had taken it over from a coalition government that had survived in the 40s, and then liberal conservative governments kind of starting with party politics of Richard McBride in 1905. So it was quite a huge sea change in the political landscape, federally, provincially, civically, and it was quite a energized, exciting time. Change was in the air and on the ground.
What about I wanted to ask about your years at the law school and the curriculum, the professors, your contemporaries. What was it? 1965. So it was before the. It was before the counterculture. Were you all fairly straight-laced? Did you wear ties and suits? Was there a dress code of?
No, there really wasn't ties and suits and sports jackets and all that. It was pretty informal, and there was a real spirit of cooperation. Like people, if you needed notes or an article. I mean, it got a little vicious in some of the law schools after that, where people hid articles from, not necessarily UBC law, but law schools started to become a lot more competitive. I mean, you could get into law school with a 60% average in those days. You know, I came in with quite a high average, but I didn't end with a high average in law because I was too busy doing other stuff. And getting high marks was not on my priority list. And after coming ninth in the class and the first term of the first year, I decided that wasn't for me, grinding out case and coming in the top 10, grinding out case briefs. And so I started to become involved in these other activities. So a pal of mine, Keith Benson, and I decided that our goal was to come in the top 4/5, right at 80th, out of 100, however many there were. And so we had a contest every year as to who could come exactly 80th out of 110. I think I won 2 out of 3. But we were right around, everybody knew that, so our marks ended up somewhere between 78 and 81, somewhere in there. So we were able to accomplish our goal, and Benson was too busy playing cards and enjoying life, and I was too busy trying to change the world. But it was a good crew. We had, and still involved, the class of 68 has a scholarship for visiting profs and a lecture every year. And Jim Taylor, to his credit, keeps his glue that keeps everybody together, the old class. Law school president.
Fat Jim.
And interesting guys. I mean, Dave Nickel went on to be the head of Loblaws. Interesting guy, you know. And he dressed to the hilt. He was an MBA grad, came out from Western and had a, I think, a Corvette or a Mustang or any of that sports car. He and I go out and play golf, and he was always dressed to the nines, and I was, you know, jeans and stuff. And he was real right, and I was left. And we got along famously. I mean, he you know, so it was quite a congenial crew.
Mm-hmm. About women, were there?
Two. There were two women.
Two.
Carolyn Askew and Ann Rolls. And Ann went on to, of course, become a Supreme Court of Appeal judge. Terrific woman. And Caroline went on to become a lawyer in I think labor law and other areas, and was quite an active feminist. And I remember her shocking us a few years ago by spewing a bunch of anger at us for being such rotten male chauvinist pigs when we were in law school. And
this was at a reunion, was it?
This was at a reunion just, you know, about 10 years ago. And thinking about it, she was right. I mean, we were, you know, collectively, I didn't think I was that bad, but some of them were, the other guys were pretty old-fashioned, in their, shall I put it that way, in their views of women and their role in that. And they didn't have, we had a male common room, and the two of them had to ask at the door for somebody to get coffee from the coffee machine. It was pretty ugly stuff. I didn't even realize that there was this kind of stuff happening, right? But those were the only two women in the class. Pretty white male class. Moni Joel was Indo-Canadian. Who turned out to be a you know, really in the top 10, a very bright lawyer, businessman in Victoria now. I'm trying to think of who else was in the class. Just ahead of us, my moot court was a former judge and attorney general, Wally Opal. But it was mostly white male population.
And the professors? Who left the
professors? Were the one that criminal law prof is an English fellow, Tony. Just trying to remember his last name, but he was quite a aggressive prof. And Jerome Atrins was also a criminal law prof, who much quieter, but he and I teamed up to, you know, to get this thread of an idea around a community law up and running. Leon Getz and David Huberman were the contract law profs, very good. Noel Lyon, the family law prof. Jurisprudence was a natural law lawyer who I really appreciated. Joe Smith was a Mormon American from the U.S., great guy. There were no women profs at the time. Charlie Bourne was the international law prof.
Mm-hmm. He just died.
Great scholar, but dry as heck. It was the age of canned notes, you know, and you go into the, we had old army huts in those days. They were just terrible old places, but we didn't notice it, actually. And he'd start giving the same lectures that he'd given for God knows how long, and he'd be reading from his notes, and he'd turn his page, and there'd be 100 people turning the same page at the canned notes. But they were, you know, it was the usual story of law school, that they break your resistance down and corrupt your mind to think like a lawyer, and scare the heck out of you in first year that you're never going to make it through. And
you said earlier that first year
they scare you to death. Second year they work you to death. And third year bore you to death. I want out of here. I want to be a lawyer. But it was tough because you had to write 7 exams in 9 days, and that was it. There was no sort of like 10 parts to your marks. It was 1 3-hour exam, and that was property law, or it was constitutional law, so you'd be all up all night on caffeine pills and just cramming for the test. But it was a very enjoyable experience, aside from that.
Mm-hmm. One last question about your undergraduate work. What did you have a particular interest?
In my BA, my English literature?
Yes.
I became very interested in writing and writing styles. And particularly the North American literature. So I took Canadian Lit, the American novel. I was quite intrigued by federalism, by federal systems, Canada, the U.S., the different kinds of legal systems, you know, the Napoleonic Code versus the common law and statutory law. And so I was just really curious. I'm curious about the underpinnings of societies and how are they formed up, and so got into that whole ancient debate back into Greece between Plato and Aristotle, and then forward into the Hobbes Rousseau debate about the difference between the Leviathan, the need for order versus natural man, that human nature is, life is true, you know, the nasty, shortish, and brute, and versus no, we're noble by human nature, but corrupted by society, and you know, and so I was intrigued by how your view of human nature and view of moving from the divine right of kings through into the bourgeois democracy and into the extension of the franchise and the evolution of our societies forward, one painful change at a time, like women getting the vote in 1917 and trade unions being allowed in the 1930s, and turning Chinese and Indo-Canadian Japanese citizens into full citizens in the 50s, and First Nations people into having some rights in 1960, and then the recognition of the rights and titles. So, you know, I was always intrigued by those, which then kind of dropped me into politics through getting mad at City Hall.
Were there any undergraduate teachers who you want to mention?
I had some very good political science and English profs. I had I try to remember her name, but a first-year English teacher who was very gentle in telling me I did. Didn't have a clue how to write a good essay, and really worked hard in our class to show us how to form up our thoughts, how to write clearly and succinctly, and get rid of clutter and get some logic to an essay. And so she was very good. And I had Roy Daniels, who was just a classic English scholar, brilliant man, who taught Milton. So I took a whole your notebook. And he'd go through your essay personally. He went through, it must be 200 people in his class, and he went through every essay himself. He'd have you in for an interview. And you go over your head and you say, oh my God, look at all those red marks all over my essay. And he'd go through it and gently, you know, say you could have said this better and you could have done that better. And you think, oh, I'm going to get a D, and you'd end up getting a B or something, or a B plus or whatever. And then I had a really good American novel prof, Dr. Stevens, who was really quite inspiring, and I got so turned on by William Faulkner and his lugubrious style that I ended up spending hours and hours and hours in the old stacks, I don't know if they still got them there, in the old library at UBC, writing a book, writing an essay on William Faulkner's The Light in August, Sex, Yoda Potawatomi County, and the Polarity, Predestination and Free Will. That's it. I had a contest with my good pal Keith Benson, who went into law school at the same time. And he came in all proudly pumped up with an 84% mark until I showed him my 87%, and that really pissed him off mightily. But it was because these professors helped me hone the ability to express myself in writing. In poli-sci, had great profs in public administration and federalism. Alan Cairns, Ed Black. I did reasonably well. I had the fourth highest mark out of 225 in Canadian federalism and got a 76%. I thought, can you be fourth out of 225 and get 76%? They said, well, we just don't give out first class marks here. I said, well, how do you get into grad school if you don't have first class marks? And I guess maybe a 76 in is like a 96 now. They just, you know, change the way they mark. But they were great teachers, and I really enjoyed them. I learned a lot. I learned political theory in my, you know, first 2 years, and the overarching information I told you about, right back to the ancient times forward, but right into the guts of it with how federalism works and the public administration and studying bureaucracies, the Peter Principle, the iron rule of oligarchy in any institution. A small number end up doing all the work and being exhausted, complaining about the apathy of the large number, and the large number complaining about not being allowed in on the decision-making process, right? Sound familiar? Mm-hmm. So there was some very interesting lessons that I picked up out of my double major in English and political science and in law school.
I used to teach history to undergraduates, and I was always kind of annoyed when the best students went to law school instead of to grad school. And I didn't really understand it. I think I understand it now. But the ones who went to grad school probably had a encouragement, perhaps, and where they were introverted. They had a topic, they had something specific they wanted to do. But it sounds like you, was it the train trip with Tommy Douglas? I mean, why law after English and poli-sci?
Well, I basically just saw that I really wasn't an academic. I mean, it wasn't my interest or lifestyle. And I was curious. I basically thought, well, you know, if you're going to change society, you better learn and not be overwhelmed or intimidated by the structure or by the rules or by the way decisions are made. Mm-hmm. And legal training seemed to be the ideal way to carry forward almost the equivalent of a PhD in political science. And then, of course, I met Tommy Douglas, and it was a very yeasty political age of the counterculture and Vietnamese war and the war on poverty and Richard Nixon getting in and the War Measures Act in 1971 and the stupidity at City Hall of urban renewal and freeways and becoming quite an arrogant, been in too long, provincial government of W.A.C. Bennett, who was probably, our, along with Richard McBride, you know, two of our great premiers, who basically brought about the development of a vastly underdeveloped province, particularly in the interior and the north. But they've been in too long. You know, and I personally think you should change governments every 8 to 10 years as a matter of principle, because the people get entitled and feel they deserve to be there. And what do you mean you don't understand the HST? And so you can be around too long. And definitely the Socrates had been around too long. But it was a very yeasty time. But I decided that, you know, the law school would be the best fit for me. And don't regret it at all. I think it was a great fit. It was a terrific training and skill you learn in honing information down to its, you know, separating the getting right at the grain and getting rid of the husk, and dealing with the foibles of human nature and the whole issue of credibility and cooperation and, you know, so certain things that, that are basic that you learn in law school, and you certainly have to become quite skilled, adept, professional to be a competent lawyer.
Your, I'm thinking of your career, your political trajectory from Strathcona, Chinatown, from that one issue into civic politics and as a mayor, ending up as a mayor of Vancouver, then premier. And that seems extraordinarily lucky to, I mean, was, I suppose every premier has to start somewhere with some political issue.
Well, it wasn't planned. I mean, I didn't, my mother told me that I told my grade two teacher when she asked what your dream is, and I said, I'm going to be the Prime Minister of Canada. But I don't remember that. I certainly didn't plan becoming the president of my high school. I was asked to run and ran and won by acclamation. And I certainly didn't expect to run for elected electoral politics. I thought I was going to be a practicing lawyer and married and have kids and all that stuff. And then I was asked to run and did and came third in the polls and I didn't anticipate running for mayor, except I didn't really agree with the then mayor, Jack Ballrich, and his approach to Expo 86, which I thought was going to have a huge debt like the 1976 Montreal Olympics did, $1.2 billion. And by the way, we did. We ended up having a $600 million debt on Expo, $200 million of which the federal government picked up with the Trade and Conference Center, their pavilion to start, and $400 million the province picked up, which is why Lotto 649 was started, to pay that off. And the city had no debt, although originally we were on the hook for 25% of that $600 million, which would have been the per capita equivalent of what Montreal citizens just paid off, I think, the last year or the year before, their share of the $1.2 billion disaster that the Olympics were. So that got me going, and I we had no plan for the site on the north side of Falls Creek. We had no rapid transit to show off. What we were going to show off is the worst transit system in the country because we'd taken out all the streetcars and interurbans and had a bunch of electric trolley buses that were falling apart. Seemed like not a very good show for the to show the world when we were having a theme, a specific World's Fair on transportation. And who was going to pay for security and parking and traffic management and what was going to happen with the low-income people in the downtown east side. So I ran for mayor because I figured I don't want to be part of this. And so I got two choices, either become the mayor and change all those things, which we did, except for some evictions of low-income people, or go back and practice law and make four times the amount of money that I was, you know, mm-hmm. then as a council member and not having enough time to really practice law in a concerted way, because, you know, it's taking a lot of time. So that was more of sort of like, I've had enough, mm-hmm. and this will decide it one way or the other. And then when I left the mayor's chair in 1986 and ran provincially, it was to be part of an NDP government, hopefully, and be the Minister of Municipal Affairs or Aboriginal Affairs. And to my horror, we had a collapse of our leadership at the time in the election. Bill Vanderzelm was elected to be leader of the SOCREDs and was charismatic. And our leader froze before the TV cameras because he had a speech impediment he hadn't told anybody about. We were down 22 points in the polls, and it was quite horrific for a while. And we went from getting a wipeout, like happened in 2001 with the NDP and happened with the federal conservatives. What was it, 92? Three? We kind of clawed our way back because Vanderzelm started to behave like Vanderzelm. And we went from getting wiped out to 22 seats, one of them being mine. But our leader, right after we all got sworn in, Bob Skelly, announced he was resigning. So my game plan wasn't happening the way it was intended to. And then everybody looked at me and I asked me to run for leader, and I did. And then Vanderzelm did what I expected him to do, which is fall apart, which he did. And we won the election in 1991. Again, none of it, you know, high school president, getting on city council, becoming mayor, becoming premier, was sort of like plotted out when ahead of time. It just kind of happened. And I feel quite privileged to have been able to do all of those terrific positions and opportunities, and help transform a city, stop a freeway, and transform a city, and be the first premier to recognize Aboriginal rights and title existed, which is why I decided to get involved in provincial politics, and start the treaty process, and end the war in the woods. You know, we had terrific turmoil, violence, conflict about logging practices and park spaces that people wanted protected, and First Nations people getting frustrated with the lack of recognition of their rights and title, and forest industry going through major changes. It was a pretty rocky time. So it was good to be able to understand public processes and how to bring in public policy and see it implemented after 14 years experience at City Hall and 5 years as leader of the opposition, to really get to know how things operate and to come up with quite an ambitious platform, about 62 different points we had, and four key areas, and like land use reform and open and honest government, and putting a great deal of emphasis on infrastructure and education, to the point where after a year and a half I had to slow everything down, just chill out everybody, focus again, because we're doing too much too fast. But I could do those kinds of things because I had the experience in dealing with the public and with the media and with public processes, you know, of a large city. And then 5 years to get the NDP ready to govern, not just be opposition.
I wanted to ask about your your mother and about your wife. Your mother you mentioned earlier in the context of Alberta. Was she a political person too?
No, she wasn't. She was a very decent United Church Christian woman who was like a super mom. Mm-hmm. And my dad was, you know, they were great parents. They allowed me lots of latitude, never put sort of restrictions or rules, make up your own mind. My wife Becky is a Norwegian immigrant. Came here at 9, didn't understand a word of English, throwing cold turkey into the system. Ended up becoming an educator, a teacher. Went through UBC, getting a teaching degree with holding down three jobs at the same time.
Did you meet her there?
No, I met her at a party in Kitsilano by an old high school friend of mine, Janice Stewart. She was having a party for her boyfriend, John, and Becky was there teaching at the same school that she was teaching at Cecil Rhodes, which became a Cole Belang at 13th and Oak. So I met her there, got married shortly after.
Great. Do you, Graham, have you picked up, now that I can think of it, the other two questions we ask sort of around this time, one is who else should we talk to? And another is what are the greatest changes you've seen in the, well, usually the question is aimed at the legal profession, but.
Well, I think we had a great class. I don't know if you and people around us. I don't know if you've talked to Wally Opal or
not yet,
or Gary Locke, who would be a very entertaining fellow to talk to. LAUK.
LAUK.
Yeah, I think it'd be good to get Carolyn Askew, Askeu, who's in Vancouver. Her sense of the place. I think she'd have quite a tart opinion. Yeah. a couple of characters. David Nichols, who I don't know, he's in Ontario now, but he went on to head up the Western Empire, you know, Loblaws. He was a fascinating fellow. And Moni Joel, who's in Victoria. Who used his legal training to be a lawyer, but also very successful and hugely respected business person. And I don't know if you've talked to Jim Taylor, but Jim would have.
We have, yeah.
Yeah, very good, very clear views about law school and his enthusiasm for being a very good lawyer. We actually had some Arnie Abramson. We had a bunch of people that went on to become quite well-respected practitioners and judges, business successes.
Changes?
Well, the big change, the one I loved, was when more than half the students were women. And 9 of the top 10 students were women. That's a profound and humiliating change for the egos of the male students. But a very good transformation of the profession and the number of people from the visible minorities, and particularly the Aboriginal, the increase of the number of Aboriginal people going into law. One of them became, still is, a good friend, Stephen Point, who became the lieutenant governor and the provincial court judge before that, and the grand chief of the Stolo Nation. Mm-hmm. That's where I first met him in the 70s. So those are very, very positive changes. And I think it's a much more egalitarian place, the law school, and far better surroundings, I might add. And the Ellerts have done a magnificent job of helping that happen. I'm on the dean's advisory committee, so we were strategizing about how you know to see that happen and what the role of the law school should be. And I think the law school is carrying on, if I should put it that way, the tradition that George Curtis allowed us to. Jerome Atrans and others to be engaged in the community. That's now not just the law school continuing to do that, but the new president of, well, not the new president, the president of UBC, Stephen Tope, has made it very clear he wants the university to be a living laboratory of sustainability and other issues and be engaged in the community. And I think the law school has carried that on.
Great. Well, good. I think maybe we should
call it there.
Call it there. Thank you.